Welcome to the Unconquered Podcast.
Lethal simplicity. I like to score fast. It's hard not to be a Noles fan. Get Florida State back. I want a damn good defense. We're still undefeated. Blame no one. Make no excuses. Do something.
Jason Staples once again here with another episode of the Unconquered Podcast. This one, going to do my best to wrap up camp. Also going to be releasing a bit of a season preview. A little bit late on that, but everything's been a little bit late lately. And then going to do a Virginia Tech preview that we'll release on probably Saturday or Sunday so that we can get that before the game. But I'm going to get a few things in here before the start of the season. Either way, exciting that football is finally here, and that is a relief for most of us, although those of us who are currently coaching, that's also a lot of extra work, so I'm still riding high after our group put up 53 this last weekend, led by 228 yards and 5 touchdowns by Andrew Hayes, who, by the way, he's a 2020 running back who camped at Florida State this last year. Kid's a baller, and they are definitely keeping an eye on him. I'm not sure whether or not he's going to actually get to the place where they'll give him a spot, but because that I know from talking to the staff that 2020 running back class is going to be really, really good. But Andrew is doing the best that he can to put himself in that discussion. This last week, certainly. He keeps repeating that, and he'll be one of those guys up in that discussion. So if you are interested in taking a look at that, take a look at my Twitter profile. I tweeted about it, I think, on Saturday or Sunday. And he's worth keeping an eye on this year, just as an interest, out of interest for, you know, potential guy that could end up on Florida State's radar as a running back / slot wide receiver. Should mention also that he is George Taliaferro's great-grandson. Taliaferro, of course, the first African-American NFL draft pick. So some pretty good bloodlines and genes there from Andrew. So I'm still, like I said, riding high from that, feeling pretty good after that. Hopefully we can, we're playing a pretty good defense this week. Hopefully we can put up a better, even better performance, which would be maybe a little bit fewer points, but we're going to need to score some points to beat this next team too. So yeah, lots of work on that end for me, but enough about my stuff. This is a Florida State podcast. Obviously, Andrew Hayes is of interest for that, but let's go ahead and move into some of the stuff that I actually wanted to talk about on this podcast. Number one is, as a lot of people had speculated over the offseason, Florida State announced this week that they will be back in black for the opener against Virginia Tech, with a blackout that first home game, dressing in the alternate uniforms. And now this is, you know, controversial for some folks, I guess. I mean, get controversy over different things. And I'll be frank on this. I think that the current alternate black uniforms and that kind of garnet to black gradient helmet, I think they're ugly. I think they're hideous, actually, and just don't look very good. They don't look a whole lot like Florida State, so I don't like them. But that's more about the 2014 redesign, which I still think was a real flop. I think Nike did a very poor job with that, and the alternates in particular that they provided Florida State with have been pretty awful. You know, I think they need to go back. I think we need to see Florida State and Nike go back to the drawing board with some other better options for alternate uniforms. So just putting that up front, I think they're ugly. I think those helmets are especially bad. I actually would have less problem going with the full black uniforms and the traditional lid, which my preference would be to do all sorts of alternate uniform stuff and keep the lid, keep the gold lid, which is as iconic as any in college football. So, you know, my rule of thumb is, given some of my background on this in terms of knowing how things work in terms of branding and all that, is it, in general, when you do alternates and that sort of thing, you still want to stay on brand. You want to keep certain things that make you distinctively you. You don't want to look like somebody else. You don't want the highlights to be in a situation where you go, hey, who is, which team is that? You want them to, you want to be recognizably Florida State. And then just in terms of other stuff, avoid gradients, which are all over the new alternates in particular. But, you know, that's right now, these are the options that that Florida State has. And you know, you've got to make the players happy. And the other thing is, quite honestly, those 2014 home redesigns with the gold numbers don't look like Florida State either. So, and I have faith that, I have full faith that Willie Taggart is going to get that fixed before too long, because again, there's enough, true Florida State DNA, traditional Florida State DNA in there that I'm sure he's going to want Florida State to look like Florida State, in terms of that. So I expect that to get fixed, but yeah, I mean, I do think at the same time, this is something that is a good thing. I think it's good to reward the players for hitting their GPA goals. It's good to reward the players for doing what they're supposed to do and give them a chance to, you know, do something a little bit different, to feel excited about what they're wearing. And, you know, it's the whole look good, play good thing, even though I don't think they're going to look good. I don't think the 2014 uniforms look especially good for what Florida State can be. And if you can get the players buzzing on this, I think that can be good. So all in all, I mean, I think that's a good idea. I do think that that announcing uniform combinations the week of, as many teams, I mean, many of you know that I cover UNC as well. UNC's equipment staff, that they've got an account where they tweet out the uniform combination, and it's a big deal with their fans every week. There are people who are on UniWatch all the time, and you know, I don't get it quite as much as some. I mean, I'm not as big. I don't really care that much, but they really, a lot of people really get excited about that, and that's another way to further keep attention and connection in terms of your program. So I think that's a good idea. That's good marketing. Now, the one thing I would really like to see, aside from the return to white numbers on the home uniforms, I would really love to see, I've always been a fan of the garnet pants on the road. I know some people disagree with me on that, but I think Florida State looks best with the white jersey and garnet pants on the road. We'll see if they end up doing that as some of the alternates on the road. But you know, going back to the like 97 defense in those garnet pants, that was how Florida State should look on the road. But anyway, enough about uniforms. A couple things. One thing I forgot to mention in the last podcast when we were talking about tempo is something that Walt Bell had mentioned this spring. And that was that one of the ways that they were really trying, and this was actually useful for me as a coach. This is something that I've implemented myself, but this is something that in order to instill what they wanted in this team, what they tried to do is, or what they emphasized is that the play isn't over when the whistle blows. So you hear teams talk about playing through the echo of the whistle and all that. The play isn't over when the whistle blows. It isn't over when the whistle echoes. For the offense at Florida State, the play is not over until everybody gets lined up again for the next play. Now the play is over, and now the next play begins. That's how they're doing this. So wide receivers, you know, you run your route. If you make the catch, you get the ball to the official and run to your spot. And only once you've run to your spot and relined up, now the play is over. But until you've actually gotten up and done all that. So what that means is you go down, you get tackled, and you pop right up, you get the ball there, and you go and you run out and you line up. That's something that they've tried to do from day one in practice to really emphasize the kind of tempo that they want to play with. I talking to some folks around the program, one of the things that actually was interesting on this is they had some trouble with some guys not really quite clicking in the spring in terms of that, but they felt really good about how that the buy-in was there. The effort in doing that stuff was there much more through the fall. And one of the things actually that was credited for that is the quality of the young wide receiver group. That young wide receiver group came in and demonstrated that they were willing to do exactly that and put that effort forward, and that they have the ability to make plays and do and start pushing those older guys. And the older guys started looking around and going, better do something. And so now all of a sudden the older group, the guys that may not have done this quite as done some of the little things quite as well, the younger guys, the competitiveness and the quality of that younger group has actually made the older group better. So that actually was interesting to hear, and actually really exciting for the future if you're a Florida State fan, that that younger wide receiver group has actually been leading from below in that regard. So that's exciting to hear. Now, I mean, obviously they're not, we're not going to see those guys really ready to play and be, you know, go-to guys. We're going to see them get incorporated for specific stuff at different points. And then over the course of the season, a couple of those guys will get more run, particularly Harrison. I think we're going to see more and more of him as the season goes on because he's special. But yeah, you're going to see those guys earn their way on as they get ready. And they're not ready yet, but they're going to be ready sooner than what we've seen young receivers do in a while, at least since Travis Rudolph, who played a ton and had a very productive freshman year. There's going to be one or two of those guys in this class, I think, even though there are some older guys that are going to be the bell cows as things go. So I've also gotten some questions about what my thoughts were on the scrimmage reports. And, you know, obviously the offense in the last two scrimmages of camp got the better of the defense, which is not the norm at this point in the season. And it's not the norm in camp. Generally speaking, defenses are ahead, and when offenses are ahead, that can be concerning. So, you know, I got some questions on whether I was concerned about the offense, having its way with the defense at times in those scrimmages. And my answer on that is yes and no. So it's always hard as a coach, it's always hard as an analyst to evaluate whether something is happening when you're practicing against yourself, when you're scrimmaging against yourself, whether this is happening because this side of the ball is really good or because this side of the ball is just not good. And I think in this case, what you're dealing with is first of all, the defense had a lot of guys out. Now the offense did, you know, they held some guys out too, but the defense is much thinner in terms of personnel than the offense. And the defense is going to depend on certain guys being on the field. And a few of those guys weren't on the field for the scrimmages. And that's going to matter a lot. In particular, I think one of the hallmarks that Willie Taggart's offense is going to have over the next few years is that I think Taggart does a really good job of identifying matchups that are advantageous and helping his quarterback to identify matchups that are advantageous for the offense and just going to that matchup, which is something that I really like as a coach, something I try to do at the high school level. It's one of those things where, you know, at the high school level, I've got a couple wide receivers that are 6'4", 6'5". Actually, I've got four guys over 6'3". That all can run, all can play. And there's a certain point where you say, don't overcomplicate it. Against a high school corner that's 5'9", 5'10", we get in the red zone, we're throwing it up to that guy. And until they can show that they can stop it, let's just go ahead and keep going to the well right there. Because our guy's better than theirs there. And I think you're going to see a lot of that from Willie Taggart, where, well, you know, they're going to keep trying to cover our slot receiver with that linebacker. Okay. We'll go to him the next 9 times. And I think that's one of the things you're going to see. And that's something that Fisher's offense didn't do as much. He was big on running through, you know, specific confines of the offense, which has its advantages as well, especially when you've got quality personnel across the board, then you can pick those matchups in a little bit different fashion. But basically what's going on there, I think, is the defense has some weaknesses. It's especially when certain personnel is not on the field. When you don't have Jackson on the field at middle linebacker, when you don't have Stanford Samuels on the field at field safety, when you don't have some of the top guys on the defensive line out there, but particularly those two guys in the back seven, when those guys aren't on the field, there are some matchups you can take advantage of. And I think that's part of it. And that's something that we're gonna have to watch over the course of the season. Is this defense is gonna be good, but it does have limitations, and particularly it's got limitations on the depth side. And there are some question marks at the linebacker position in particular. We talked about that going back as far as the spring. Now, I do think that as Jaden Woodby settles in at that star position, I think that that concern is going to be less and less over the course of the season. But if he gets hurt, they're in real trouble. You know, Jackson needs to be on the field at middle linebacker, even though Warner is one of the better backups they've got. You know, they could sustain that, but the other linebacker position is a real liability. And looking at the depth chart, you've got Brooks, DeKalon Brooks as the starter there. And listen, I mean, I got to see Brooks in person in practice, and you know, he's limited physically. He does not look like what you would expect from a Florida State linebacker. And yeah, his dad was undersized too and all that, but he's smaller than his dad. I've stood next to his dad. DeKalon is a good bit smaller than his dad. Now, there's a lot of similarities in terms of how they even walk, but you know, he doesn't look the part in that regard. And there's certain physicality things that, you know, he just doesn't bring to the table that you would hope to have at that position. But the thing is, you are going to get great effort, and you've got a kid that can cover pretty well. So, you know, you can do what you can there. But they just don't have that third linebacker that you would expect at Florida State. So they're going to have to scheme around that a little bit. They're going to have to make sure that, you know, in certain cases, they may get a DB on there. You know, they're going to do the best they can to get that position shored up. But that's something that teams are going to try to take advantage of. And the offense is going to be able to do that. So, yeah, that's where my concerns are on defense. And also, you know, you need to get Marvin Wilson on the field as he gets healthy. You know, Josh Kando, once he eventually gets healthy, you know, you're going to need to see those guys get out there to make that defense better and deeper. But you know, the defense is going to be, I think they'll be good, but I don't think that's going to be right out the gate, especially with those guys still, a couple of those guys still limited from getting banged up or from off-season surgery, all that. I don't think they're going to be great out the gate. And especially in a new scheme. I mean, even though the scheme is simplified, even though there's a lot of stuff, a lot of advantages to what they're doing in terms of fitting the personnel, there's going to be some growing pains. And depth wise, again, you're really scared if there are a couple of those guys that go down. So, yeah, there's some concerns there. But on the flip side, I also am more optimistic about the offense. I think that suggests that the matchups that they're wanting to get, in terms of wide receivers against, you know, in space, getting running backs in space, creating some of those conflicts for the defense, they're doing a good job of that, identifying it and those guys are making plays. I also think it's a good sign in terms of the offensive line, and word is that they're actually feeling pretty comfortable about that starting five. They feel pretty good about it, and they should. I mean, if you think about it in the running game, that starting five is pretty good. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes in terms of depth chart. Actually, let's go ahead and get into the depth chart. And first things first, as expected, DeAndre Francois wound up winning the job. The question with him was always going to be leadership and whether or not he was going to do the things necessary to actually win this team back over. And it's very clear that he did that. And he performed the best in the scrimmages. He made it a pretty easy decision. So that's a good thing. You've got your oldest, most experienced, and generally most talented quarterback that actually did the job to make that decision easy. Great. Okay. So move on from there. Now, it's interesting. I'm not sure which one would be the first off the bench to take his place if he ended up getting hurt. I wouldn't be surprised if it's Bailey Hockman at this point. But, you know, they're listed as an or in the starting lineup. So, you know, it's worth noting that. Now, in terms of the wide receiver position, those of you who've listened to this show are not surprised at all that the only guy that actually is listed as the clear starter, as a clear starter, is Keith Gavin. And going back to the spring, he was the one guy that, despite all of the hype and attention that the young guys got from the media, the one guy that I was hearing from sources inside where the Gavin was the best guy, the most consistent guy, and the best guy that they had in practice, that he was going to be the one guy that was consistent out there. And yeah, he needed to get more consistent, but he was the best guy they had. And that has basically persisted through camp. That said, I really expect that the starting three, ultimately, you know, the first three on the field is going to be Gavin, Murray, and Terry. But we'll see. We'll see how the rotation goes. In terms of who's the starter at wide receiver, it's not going to matter as much because they're going to play eight. You know, there are some people who really wish that, you know, that there were people that pushed for Jimbo Fisher and Lawrence Dawsey to only play, you know, to narrow their receiver rotation because of the belief that, you know, you want to play fewer receivers to make sure that you have more rhythm and that and so on with the quarterback. I've always been a proponent of playing more receivers if you have them, and they do have them this year, and they're going to play them. And with the up-tempo style, they want to play eight receivers as a rule. That's just what they believe that they need eight wide receivers to run this offense the way that they want to run it at the speed that they want to run it with the number of reps that they're going to get to put the pressure on the defense. And again, you think about it, you don't rotate corners as often as you rotate receivers if you're rotating like that. And so by the fourth quarter, those receivers are fresher than the guys that have been covering them. So that definitely helps late in games where those guys are potentially able to run by the more gassed defender. So that's something that we're going to see a little bit more. You know, but we'll see what happens with the rest of it. You know, there's some speculation on, you know, what happened with Terry. You know, he was the guy that was getting all the buzz. Nothing is surprising here. You know, Terry is listed as an or with Ontario Wilson and Treshawn Harrison, and both of those guys earned that or. Now, again, I think Terry's probably going to be the first guy in the field, but they're all going to rotate. And you're just going to see less rotation from Gavin. Gavin's going to be the guy that's going to be on the field the most of the group, with Warren Thompson also, you know, getting out there on occasion, but he's just not ready to be an every down contributor, to be in the rotation as consistently as the guys that are listed as oars. DJ Matthews, Keyshawn Helton, Ontario Wilson, and Treshawn Harrison are all guys that you're going to see more on the field in terms of rotation. That's why they get or. You think about it, the statement that, or the saying that we used to have, and that I still tell my receivers, is it doesn't matter who starts the game. What matters is who gets what reps. And all they're communicating with the receiver depth chart is essentially who's going to be getting how many reps. And what that means is Gavin's going to be getting the most out of the receiving core as a whole. And then you're going to see Nyquan Murray, DJ Matthews, Keyshawn Helton, Tamorian Terry, Treshawn Harrison, and Ontario Wilson split a lot of the rest. That's six more guys. You're going to see a lot of those guys rotating in and out of different spots. So that should hopefully make some sense of that. As for the running back depth chart, not surprising at all. Again, Akers, Patrick, LeBourne, Rasul, Grant. Listing five was surprising to some people, but again, they're going to play as many as three or four. We've said since what, December, I think I was on this show explaining that Taggart will have three running backs on the field at once, more often than you'd expect. It's going to happen. He's going to have running backs in the slot. He's going to run some diamond. He's going to do all sorts of stuff to get that talented running group on the field as much as possible and do it together. So you're going to see guys moving around in different positions and used in the passing game and all sorts of things just to get them out there. And the other thing is that he understands that as much as he's going to run the ball, he's going to need to rotate some backs. He's going to need to have guys are going to get banged up, and you're going to have to get guys moving in and out of there to make sure that people stay fresh. So, and he hasn't rotated carries as much in the past, but that's partly because he's never had this kind of depth at the position. So, you know, that is what it is. I mean, and again, you've got Akers, who's your most complete back. You've got Patrick, who's your big back. And then you've got LeBourne, who's your, you know, jump cut, not quite as big and certainly not as fast as Akers. I mean, you hear about LeBourne being one of the faster players on the team. He's one of the quickest players on the team, but he's a 4.6 guy. Akers is a good bit faster than LeBourne when it comes to going in a straight line. Now, if you want to talk about the burner, Rasul has his role there too. And again, one of the things I really like is that they've got Rasul listed as the primary kick returner. They've got Rasul and Anthony Grant as primary kick returners. And then I guess, you know, maybe the last staff was not completely crazy and having Keith Gavin out there. Although this year they've got more depth at receiver. So if he does get hurt there, you know, they've got that, but Gavin is still one of the starters at kick return. So, you know, I didn't like it last year. Still don't like it that much this year. I prefer having LeBourne there. He's the guy that's backing up Gavin as the primary, the secondary kick returner, along with Rasul as the primary, but we'll see how that goes. Again, I'd rather have Rasul and LeBourne back there, my preference, but I don't see these guys every day in practice, and those guys do. So, yeah. Now, on the offensive line, it's basically what we've seen. Juwan Williams, Derek Kelly, Alec Eberle going left to right. Alec Eberle, you know, being the rock at center. A lot of people at this point don't understand how good Eberle actually is at center. Everybody remembers him as a sophomore when he was having the hip injuries and he never should have been on the field that early and all that. He's a pretty good player now. You can rely on him. And then the right side is where you've got your biggest question marks, aside from can Juwan Williams stay healthy. You've got Landon Dickerson, also a question of whether he can stay healthy at right tackle. And then the one surprise up front was either Mike Arnold or Cole Minshew at that right guard position. I think that's more of a nod to Minshew being, you know, dinged up here and there. So, you know, Arnold being the guy that would be on the field if Minshew is not for health reasons. The thing that I want to point out about this, they feel pretty comfortable about that group. And honestly, as long as Williams and Dickerson stay healthy on the year, I think that offensive line can be pretty good. I think if Williams or Dickerson get hurt, then you're going to see Derek Kelly move to tackle and Arthur Williams be the starter at the left guard spot. And there's been some really good things said about Arthur Williams accommodating to that spot. I thought maybe he should have moved there earlier, but, you know, last staff kept him at tackle. I thought maybe he could have helped a little bit earlier on the offensive line had he moved. But in any case, the thing that sticks out to me about this offensive line is I think this is going to be a really good run blocking line. You look at Kelly, Eberle, and then either Arnold or Minshew on the interior, and as much as they're going to run the football, as much as they're just going to pound the rock, and Dickerson at right tackle, from left guard to right tackle, that's a bunch of guys that can maul. Those are guys that are physical. You know, Eberle has gotten bigger and gotten a lot stronger this offseason now that he's, you know, had those surgeries and he's better off there. I wouldn't be surprised to see him have kind of a Brian Stork senior year. I mean, Stork was not that good as a sophomore, but he was pretty good as a senior and, you know, ended up being an NFL player. I think it's going to be interesting to see these guys run block. This is a line that actually is set up to run block pretty dang well. They're big, they're physical, and if they can stay healthy, I'm pretty optimistic. And they're not going to ask him to do a whole lot of drop back pass blocking. Taggart's offense is a lot more conservative in that regard than Jimbo Fisher's offense. Now, I should clarify there. The conservative is a tricky term when it comes to talking about offense, because what does it mean to be conservative? For me, if you're a run-heavy offense and basically you're going to run the ball, play action, pass, you know, take your shot, that's a more conservative approach than an offense that's going to put the ball in the air a bunch and throw short and throw intermediate, particularly intermediate, because of the potential turnover results of short and intermediate throws. And really what you're going to see from Taggart is there's going to be complaints, I can promise you. There will be fans after the first few weeks that are going to go, I didn't realize his offense is going to be so predictable. Now, they'll still score points, and so it may take a little while for people to get to this point, but you know, after the first loss or two that Taggart ever has, there's going to be criticism at some point of, man, this offense is just so predictable. They lined up and I just knew they were going to run power. For the people that know what power is, I knew they were going to run the ball right there. You're going to hear a lot of that because they're going to do a lot of it. But Taggart believes in establishing the run. This is a Jim Harbaugh offense Jim Harbaugh style offense at its core. All they did is they took what Jim Harbaugh did at Stanford and elsewhere, they took that and they blew air into it Baylor style, and they're incorporating, you know, some RPO game in terms of bubble screens and, you know, some quick slants and things on the front side, doing some of that stuff to cause some additional problems so that they can pound it even more on the inside. So they're going to pound the ball, and they're going to pound the ball some more, and then they're going to play action pass and take a shot. And when you load up to pound it, to keep them from pounding it, they're going to throw it out wide on quick screens and, you know, quick stuff where there's very little chance of turnover. Basically an extension of the running game. So, you know, those bubbles and ace deuce trouble game. I can post some links to that in the future. I'll break that down at some point. But screen game to, you know, the number one, number two, or number three receiver out there, depending on the defensive look on the backside of the run play, doing all that stuff based on box count. that stuff is what they're going to do. And that's really a run play. Throwing it behind the line, there's very little risk involved. It's conservative, but it's also opening up the potential shot plays downfield. And when you take those shots, you've got a chance of a big play or usually an incompletion. You're rarely going to get, say, a shot play throwing a play action vertical, you know, play action wheel or a play action, go route to a wide receiver. That's rarely going to get picked off because a receiver has a chance to play DB if it's a bad throw and, you know, or the quarterback's going to overthrow or throw it out of bounds. So it's actually a conservative approach, but it's also an approach that can lead to a lot of big plays. So that's what we're going to see. And given that, this offensive line actually could be, if they can stay healthy, and particularly they've got to stay healthy at tackle, if they can stay healthy at tackle, this offensive line could really be surprising by the end of the year. But again, they have to stay healthy at tackle. The problem on the offensive line right now is the lack of depth. That second group at tackle is scary. And, you know, they're just going to have to, they're going to have to stay healthy up front. And if they can do that, they can be pretty dang good. Now, defensively, no surprises. You know, Corey Durden, second string behind DeMarcus Christmas. Durden was a stud coming out. Not surprising. Ime actually worked his way ahead of Janarius Robinson. Janarius, they'll split reps, but Ime ended up finally pulling ahead by the end of camp. Kando really has been very limited, but he's backing up Brian Burns. And then again, you know, the question was going to be at linebacker, and it looks like DeKalon Brooks is going to be on the field as much as anybody because Adonis Thomas just not been physical enough. That was the knock on him when he transferred from Alabama, and it's continued to be the problem since he got to Florida State. And Emmett Rice has been banged up and just not, he's not been able to really make the strides at that position that they wanted. So, you know, you're not feeling real good about that spot. In the secondary, as long as Stan Samuels, the third, is at field safety, you feel good. Because then you can cover basically what you need to out of the slot. If he's not out there, then there's some concerns on this defense. Otherwise, you know, you feel pretty good. I think it's going to be interesting. Interesting to see how that personnel gels and see whether a few of those players that they're hoping to get to step up actually step up. It's going to be interesting. Now, we're going to finish this show with a few Q&As, and I'm going to leave off for a few additional things in a season preview episode as well, but I'm going to take a few Q&As that have come in over the past few weeks. First one, how does this new college football rule that you can only have 20 headsets on at the same time affect teams? How is this going to affect FSU? It's going to affect FSU some. The teams that it really affects are the Bamas of this world that could have, you know, 50 guys on the phones at a given time. But honestly, I don't think it's going to make that much of a difference because you don't want the phones being clogged by a bunch of people talking anyway. You're still going to have the same people in the box talking back and forth in the box between possessions and all that. And then there's going to be the voices on the phones that are going to pass that down. So it's not going to make that big of a difference. Now, one place where it will make a difference is in signal stealing. One of the things that your well-heeled programs spend a lot of time on and a lot of resources on is signal stealing, and you have people in the box with binoculars, and their sole job is to watch the other sideline and do everything they can to steal signals based on the research that you've gotten on that team. And, you know, some teams will trade secrets in terms of what signals, you know, this and that coach have, you know, this is that formation, this is this particular concept when you see this signal and so on. And so you can pass that down. And if you're on defense, we saw the, you know, outside zone signal, so we're going to alert our defense to outside zone. Now, if you've got fewer coaches on the phones, then, you know, there are few, you can devote fewer coaches to stealing signals that can actually pipe up with what they just caught if you end up in that situation. So, but even there, you know, 20 is still a lot. I mean, that's 10 on either side of the ball. That's a lot. I mean, there's only there's 10 now with this year. There's 10 actual official assistant coaches as it is. So that's 10 plus each of them having their own assistant Really, that's eight of them plus their own assistant, and then Willie Taggart having his own, and then maybe Mickey Andrews having his. You know, that's how that affects it. I don't think it makes that big of a difference beyond, you know, leveling the playing field just a little bit with, you know, a team like Bama that might have another 15 if they wanted. As for the next question, what do I think about Walt Bell being in the coach's box? Do you put another offensive coach up there like Telly Lockett? Well, first of all, I think Bell being in the coach's box is a great idea. I think having talked to Walt, he is a very sharp and very quick offensive mind. And I think you want him up there to make sure that he's seeing everything from the bird's eye. He might be, in terms of schematically, the quickest guy on the staff in terms, and the other than Taggart, the one that knows best what they really want to do. So yeah, I think it's a great idea to have him up there. You know, to be able to see each thing and pass down you know, some options for Taggart on the sideline. Now, as for putting another offensive coach up there, yeah, you do. You might put your run coordinator up there. You might, you know, it might be Telly Lockett. It might be your run coordinator in Greg Fry. Odds are you probably have Fry downstairs to do some chalkboard stuff with the offensive line. But again, you want at least one other offensive coach up there, and you're going to have a couple of GAs up there as well. You know, you're going to have your offensive, your primary offensive GA is going to be up there on the phones as well. So you definitely want those guys in the box. Okay, next question. What are your thoughts about Landon Dickerson at right tackle? And then what do you think about Stanford Samuels playing safety? Did you see this coming? I've talked a little bit about the Stanford Samuels move on the last episode, and I didn't exactly see it coming, but as I was playing around with different things, that was one of the things that I would have done. Thinking about you need to have a third corner in this system to be able to play safety, and he's the one guy that's physical enough and big enough to do both. And that role, you've got to be able to handle the two-way go from the slot, and he's the one guy that I think makes sense there. So yeah, I think it's a great idea. As for Landon Dickerson at right tackle, you know, I thought maybe they'd go with Kelly there and then have Dickerson at guard, but ultimately I think they just decided that with Kelly's injury history and with Dickerson's recovery and all of that, that Dickerson was probably the more mobile guy at right tackle to be able to do what they wanted to do. And Dickerson is a versatile guy, so it makes sense to have him there. Either way, in this offense, you need a guy that can really be a road grader, a run blocker there. So it makes sense, but you know, it's not ideal. Ideally, you'd have him at right guard, and you'd have, say, Josh Ball at right tackle, but they don't have that. So that's that. As far as the rest of the thoughts on the, you know, I was asked to give my thoughts on the O-line. Already did that in this episode. One last question to go on. Actually, two last questions. One is Dalvin. I get the choice of Dalvin in 2015 going into the season or Akers in 2018 going into the season. Which one would I choose? Well, I have the benefit of hindsight here. I can't not go with Dalvin. Partly because I know in advance what that offense is going to look like and how, you know, the kind of situation in terms of that offense being built for a guy like Dalvin. And Akers, in terms of what they're going to be doing in this offense, it's maybe not quite as perfect a fit as it was for Dalvin in 2015. And Akers, you know, still has a little bit of room to grow. That said, it's entirely possible that Akers ends up having that kind of 2018. And if I was talking about a back to bet on future in terms of long term, Dalvin 2015 or Akers 2018, I think Akers is a more talented player. So, you know, take that for what you will. Final question has to do with the situation at Maryland, where, you know, they had lots of stuff come out after the death of a player. And I got the following question. What's your take on what happened at Maryland? Don't basically all schools have that kind of degrading workout culture? Isn't that type of intimidation prevalent everywhere? My answer to that is no. Now, you have guys that yell and scream. You have guys that'll swear at you. You have all sorts of stuff that is pretty prevalent all across the board. But the kind of stuff that was reported about Maryland in terms of the kinds of insults at the players, questioning all sorts of things about the players, and the approach that they took was like two notches past what you're normally going to see. And it's certainly not the way that you're going to see things at Florida State now. That's one of the things, actually, talking to the Florida State coaching staff and watching them in practice after I had talked to them about this. You know, I'd talked to a couple guys before they took the job and then got to see in practice how things actually were working and got to see that they were actually telling the truth. Their belief is there's no need to sit there and curse a bunch at a kid. You know, we're not going to yell and scream and make a fuss. We're just going to hold them accountable. That's their view. If he doesn't want to do it, then we'll find somebody that does. We're going to hold him accountable. We're going to require that he does certain things. If he's not going to do those, then we'll move on. But we're not going to yell and scream and make a fuss and swear at a kid because I wouldn't want somebody doing that to me. Would you want somebody doing that to you in your workplace? That was what I was asked. And honestly, I agree with that. I don't, you know, curse and swear at my players. I might yell at them sometimes, you know, what are you doing? All sorts of stuff. But again, you can do all of that without getting demeaning and without reaching into the point of dehumanizing your player. And I think that's what they were doing at Maryland. And that's very different from what you're seeing at places like Florida State, where that's just not accepted. That's something that Taggart doesn't believe in. And the rest of that staff doesn't believe in. Why do you think Walt Bell left? Anyway, that'll do it for this episode of the Unconquered Podcast. Want to thank my sponsors. Hadn't done that just yet, but check the show notes for more about the sponsors. Luis Marquez from Keller Williams Realty in Jacksonville, Florida. Garage Makeovers down in South Florida. If you're down there, that's the best garage people and organization people you can ask for. And also Resolution Home Loans. Chad and Shannon will take care of you if you need to get your home loan taken care of. Let them know that you heard about it from the Unconquered Podcast. Let them know that I sent you, and it'll definitely help me out a bunch. All right, that'll do it for us here on the Unconquered Podcast. Once again, I'm your host, Jason Staples. Thanks for listening.
Thank you all very much, and have a great day if you want to.
I made this.